Daniel 11, verse 17, approximately. And let me just review just a little bit. Let's see, now is this going to change? There we go, there's Daniel again. And if we bring that map up that you had of the four parts, that would be very helpful. Now, I put the rulers on the board over here so I don't have to flip back and forth all the time. They're up here all the time. And we've gone through all of these rulers from Daniel chapter 11. Verse 5 talks about Ptolemy Soter. These are all Ptolemies, by the way, so I didn't write the word Ptolemy over and over. Over here, they kept going back and forth between Seleucus and Antiochus. Antiochus, Seleucus, Seleucus, Antiochus, Seleucus, Antiochus. So I didn't, you know, I just put an A or an S there. They just kept repeating those names just like Ptolemy did over here. So we're down to Callinicus, and then, you know, he died by falling off a horse. His two sons want to avenge the loss that he suffered by Egypt. So Cyrenus and Magnus, he reigned for 3 years. He for 36, they prepared to invade Egypt. But only one of them, it says, is going to come against Egypt, and that was Magnus. So that was what we've read about. And we read down through verse 16. And verse 16, he that comes against him shall do according to his will. None shall stand before him. He will stand in the glorious land. What's the glorious land?
Israel.
That's Israel, yeah. That means Magnus is going to come down and take this area. Now, this isn't map 1, but keep it there for a moment. You're so quick. Go back to that map. Okay. Yeah, now, this is what... Brother Stefan, thank you. Found for me. I got all these Greek names in my mind, you know. It's switched to Romanian now. Brother Stefan found for me. There's Seleucia. That's one we were trying to look for before. That's that the capital of the Syrian Empire that the king of Egypt had come up and have taken that fortress. And before Magnus decided to go against Egypt, Magnus had to first take his own capital back again. And he did that. And once he did that, then it turned out he wasn't a really beloved king, this Magnus, and he lost a lot of ships out here in a violent storm or some conflagration out in the Mediterranean. He lost a lot, and it actually worked to his benefit because his subjects became more sympathetic to his experience, his cause, and he began to be a more attractive leader for all of them. And then down here in Egypt, something happened. Now, I didn't say this before, but in the reading that I did, you know, during the break, trying to refresh my own memory on these details, one of these comments says, let's see if I can find this now, that Eugertes was about the last of the nobly inclined rulers. Now, you know, that's in quote marks, you know, these folks are not all, these are all bloody people. But he had some measure of integrity. That's what the expression was, some measure of integrity. This person that followed him is called Philopater. Now, what does pater mean, P-A-T-E-R? Father. Philo means, kind of like filio. Kind of like that. Let's see, filio is kind of a love, brotherly love, right? That's what the New Testament, brotherly love, and then there's agape. So that was actually given to him by his subjects, kind of in sarcasm. Father lover. You know why? Because the thought is that he actually killed his father, or had his father killed. That's a nice son, isn't it? And so they named him sarcastically father lover. But not only that, but after a while, he disposed of his mother, his uncle, and his, I guess, cousin, his uncle's brother, or something like that. So this Philopater was not a pleasant person, even by standards of kings. That's why they say this was the last one with some measure of integrity, and the rest of them kind of dilapidated from there. So anyway, Magnus. The fact is he wasn't a particularly beloved person, and then when he passed from the scene, and Epiphanes, as a child, took over. Now it was the chance for Magnus to take over that little kingdom. And so Magnus prepared his way and he started advancing. That's what we've read about. He's ready to take the kingdom, but he says, you know, it's going to be a lot of trouble. I think I'll marry my daughter off to the king, and it'll be easier for me to control. But she switched alliances. in her heart and went to her husband, so he didn't accomplish what he wanted. So now we're down to verse 17, and that's the second marriage alliance of this narrative. Verse 17, that's when Magnus gives his daughter over to the king of Egypt. Now let's go back to the other slide, if we would. So, you see that Ptolemy, the kingdom of Egypt, really has dominion of this area. But when Magnus made this marriage alliance, Magnus said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll give this back to you, this area, back to Egypt, even though he had conquered it. He stood in the glorious land and took all that. We just read that. He says, I'll give it back to you as dowry for my daughter. And so anyway, he's supposed to give that back, but then he never quite followed through with that. So he still had it. And so the next king that comes along, Philometor, he says, you know, I was promised, we were promised to get that land back, but we don't have it. And so we really would like it back. And but I'm ahead of my story here. Let's go back to Magnus. We're almost finished with him. And then when we finish with Magnus, I'm going to step back and take a perspective on different approaches to Daniel. And then we'll finish the rest of it after that. But let's go to verse 18 and 19. Then we're finished with that Magnus, and we're ready for the next part. 18 and 19. Who can read the... Kelly, do you have your Bible open in front of you? Daniel 11, 18. We won't go to 19 quite yet. What version are you using, man? NIV or NASB?
No, it's the English Standard.
Okay, so it's a modern version.
Mm-hmm. And that was Daniel 11...
18.
18, thank you. Okay. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him.
Okay, now what Antiochus Magnus did, once he married his daughter off to here and he felt secure there, is he went over here, and this is, let's see, now this is Greece, that's Rome, that's Italy, this is Turkey here, right? And so, now I would have, this is strange, I would have thought the Dardanelles would open up a passage in here in the sea. This is a little, this map is a little strange to me. Kind of distorted, yeah, it does seem a little bit. So Turkey is kind of a thing that sticks out like this, like kind of a big bulb. And so he went along the coastlands here, and he took all of these. He took some of the Greek Isles, and here he took a lot of that area. And Magnus really was doing pretty good. And then, of course, when you get a little bit too successful, somebody else says, hey, I would have liked that piece of pie. And who is that that's going to be a competitor to him? Jeff, what do you think that would be?
I don't know. I was actually thinking this thing elsewhere. Oh, okay. All right.
Well, that's about the time Rome says, you know, we got our own eye over here. Yeah. So Rome says, you know, we don't like what you're doing. So they sent a general. His name was Scipio. I don't know how you say it. S-C-I-P-I-O. And they sent a general out there to push him back. And the general from Rome had a great victory over Magnus. And they put Magnus under a huge debt. It was like 1,000 talents per year for 12 or 20 years, something like that. Boy, this is an onerous debt to pay. But then he does have a big kingdom to pay it with, doesn't he? So, you know, he goes to start plundering the parts of his empire and taxing them to try to pay it. This is still Magnus. Well, that's what verse 18 says. He shall turn his attention to the isles and take many. But this Roman prince shall come on behalf of the reproach offered to him and cause him to cease. And verse 19, as a result of the taxation he was imposed in, Kelly, would you read 19?
Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found.
So he went back here and he actually plundered a temple to go get some riches for himself, and the people of the temple says, no, we don't really like this, and they killed him. They overwhelmed him and killed him. So Magnus came to an inglorious end because of this taxation that was his tribute he was imposed on by Rome. So it was Rome that intervened here and really stopped the flow of these Grecian kingdoms. Yes?
In addition to that, I think one of the other things that probably made the Romans angry was that Antiochus was allied with Hannibal from Carthage, so that was would have been appealing to the Romans.
Now, I was not aware of that. He had an ally over here in Carthage, Hannibal.
Yes.
And Hannibal is the one that finally crossed the Alps and went down and really created a problem for Rome. Okay, that's a little a political flavor I wasn't aware of. Brother Paul.
What's the B.C. date can you kind of fill in dates when you do this?
Yeah, for Magnus? Yeah, I could do that. I'll have to do a little calculation to do that. Let's see, where's my... I got a calculator here. Oh, I had some numbers up there before, didn't I? I think I had 323 for the beginning of Ptolemy. Is that right?
Yes.
323, and I had a date over here of 312. Okay, so if we want to take it to the end of the reign of Magnus, we got 312 plus 32. No, I'm going the wrong way. 312 minus 32, minus 19, minus 15, minus 20, minus 3, minus 36. We're down to 187 BC by the end of the reign of Magnus. 187 BC. Plus or minus a year, I'm pretty sure that's about right.
That's when his reign ends.
Ends, that's correct. That's when it ends. Bill, did you have a comment? Okay. Was there another hand back here somewhere? Okay. Now, that's where Magnus ends. Now, I'll go one more verse, because one more verse will cover the entire reign of Seleucus Philopater. Is that Philopater? Is that something like that. Okay. And that's verse 20. Now, remember, Magnus is under the gun for paying tribute to Rome. So his successor, who is his son, has a problem meeting that same obligation. And so he's going to go down to Jerusalem, where he is told there's a large amount of money at the temple. So, well, that sounds pretty good. That really should be mine. So there's a gentleman that was the high priest at this time in Israel. Is a very good man. His name was Onias. And in the book of Maccabees, you can read about him. He was a righteous man, a good man. And he had an evil friend, or I don't know what you call it, friend, associate. His name was Simon. And he had a falling out with Onias because Onias was so righteous he wouldn't let the other person get away with some of his illicit gain. So he went up here and he told the king up here, that would be Philopater, he says, you know, there's a treasure at Jerusalem and it really should be yours. And he exaggerated the treasure, how great it was. He says, that will help you pay your debt to Rome. So Philopater sent his trusted treasurer, a man named Heliodorus, down into Jerusalem to go get this treasure. And so all of the Israelites, they told him, please don't do this. I mean, Onias said, no, the treasure is not as great as you think. It is a large amount, so many talents of gold and silver, but it's really committed for the widows and the poor and the orphans, and we're administering it justly. And don't take this. So all the people began praying, but he's going to go down and take it anyway, Heliodorus. Do you know the story? The story of this appears in the book of Maccabees. You can read about it. Maccabees isn't inspired, but it's pretty good history. You can bet all the apostles and the early New Testament Christians, they knew about the book of Maccabees. They knew this whole history. And I find it fascinating reading. Well, Heliodorus went in to take it, and he got beat up. Who beat him up? Not the high priest. An angel beat him up. Suddenly from above came down an angelic host and they really had to let him have it. That's the way the book of Maccabees represents it. I actually think it's right. I think it's credible. I think that's really what happened. And so he went back in dishonor and told Philopater, sorry, it's not what I thought was there, you know. I mean, it made it some ruse, you know. But it was a notable experience in the history of Israel. So we begin to have in prophecy here something that is actually in, I can't say sacred writ, but I can say deeply in cultural, Jewish cultural history writ, something that all the disciples would be aware of. And that's verse 20, then shall stand up in the estate of Magnus a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. Now, what is the glory of the kingdom? What does that refer to? Earlier we read about a glorious land. What land was that? Israel. That's the glory here. If you look at Isaiah 4, verse 5, maybe somebody can read that for me, look it up. Isaiah 4, 5. Brother Ed, you're on your way there? Okay. Isaiah 4, 5 uses this word glory also to refer to Israel. And I think that this is talking about he's going to go down to Israel and tax that, if he can, but it turns out to be unsuccessful. Go ahead.
And the Lord will create upon every dwelling place a
mountain.
Microphone.
Oh, yeah, Mike. Sorry.
And the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense.
Upon all the glory shall be a defense. And that's referring to the land of Israel. That's the glory. And so here, this estate, this raiser of taxes was going to tax the glory of the kingdom. I think he's talking about Israel. He went down to get the temple wealth. But he was unsuccessful. Within a few days, this king, Philopater, shall be destroyed. You notice it doesn't say he died peacefully in his sleep. He is destroyed. He doesn't just die a natural death. But it says, not in anger and not in battle. What is this? He was destroyed, so he didn't die natural death, but not in battle. Okay, so it wasn't an armed conflict. He didn't die in battle. And not in anger. It wasn't like a dispute from an angry partisan or something. But he did die in a palace coup. It was a political thing. Wasn't they, angry against him. It was a political palace coup, and he died in the palace coup. Simple as that. So it's kind of an interesting way. Of all these rulers, how did they all die? Well, Magnus was killed because they hated him, for robbing their treasure, so he didn't die in peace. He died in anger. Some of them, I don't know if any of them died in battle. Most of them probably died in old age, and stuff. Oh, I know how this guy died. See, one of them, I know he was poisoned by his wife. We know that, yeah. We talked about that. So, but that's a rather unique thing. He didn't die peacefully. He died in a palace coup, but it wasn't in battle, and it wasn't because, great anger or something. It wasn't like a fight of somebody that hated him. So his sons are ready to take over. Oh, that was this person, Philopater. But his son doesn't take over. As a matter of fact, his brother takes over. Now, where's Antiochus Epiphanes in this picture? Well, he has actually been captive in Rome. When his father, Magnus, made a deal with the Romans and accepted the taxation, they said, well, I'm glad you've agreed to pay us our annual 1,000 talents of silver or whatever it was, but we need a little collateral here. Well, what would you like? Well, your son will be okay. And so Antiochus Epiphanes was actually in captivity to Rome, to make sure they were going to, the debt would be paid. He was one of a number of people that went there. But as time went by, he was exchanged. When Philopater became king, he got out, and instead a son of Philopater got into Rome to take his place as security for this obligation. So he's out. And it turns out that another son of Philopater is going to take the throne when Philopater dies. But he's a young son. He needs somebody to rule on his behalf. So his uncle volunteers to take that duty, and Antiochus Epiphanes, the uncle of the next young ruler, says, I'll be a regent on his behalf. A regent is a person that's ruling on behalf of a minor. So he does that, and he does that until he thinks he can get away with it, and so then he just disposed of that and became king himself. That's why he came in by flatteries, and he's not authorized, but he reigns to pull the strings and become king. This is the inglorious Antiochus Epiphanes. That wasn't his name. His name was Mithraides or something like that. But he said, well, I'm going to call myself Epiphanes, which means glorious or brilliant or something. Epiphania, we have that word. He says, I like that. That described me, the bright, shining, the wonderful person. And his subject said, we'll call him Epimanes, which means madman. They didn't like him too much. But anyway, that's the story behind his name. Now, the rest of the verses, verse 21 and forward, in my opinion, deal with Epiphanes. I think that's true all the way down to verse 31. But at this point, before going through all that history, we've got to step back and take a little perspective here. Here's the problem that all the expositors have when they deal with Daniel, the 11th chapter. Everybody knows that when you go back to verse 3, we're talking about Alexander the Great. Okay? Now, that was clear when we went through there. And at verse 4, the four generals, you know, or four people take the king. That's clear. Everybody knows that's verse 4. At verse 5, that would be Ptolemy and Seleucus, and everybody knows that. Nobody disputes it. When you get down to verse 6, there's the marriage alliance between Theus and Philadelphus. Everybody agrees with that. That's so clear. Everybody knows that's true. But if you get down to verse 10, the sons are Serenus and Magnus that were sons of Callinicus. We've gone through all that history. Everybody agrees with that. But you got to scratch your head and say, now, wait a minute. If you keep on going like this, generation for generation, how are you going to finally get to the second advent of Christ? Something's got to change somewhere. Let's go to Daniel 12, verse 1. Daniel 12, 1 is that famous text that says, "Then shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which stands for the children of thy people. There will be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. At that time thy people shall be delivered, everyone that's found written in the book." Verse 2, "And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake." What's that talking about? The resurrection, right? How do you get from Alexander and these kings way back when all the way to the resurrection in the millennial age if you're going generation by generation? You know, it's not going to work. That's what every expositor has to figure out. And so different expositors have tried different things to jump over this gap. You know, people that believe in the book of Daniel. And what the Adventists did, now there's a very famous Adventist writer, his name is Uriah Smith. I have his book at home. It was my father's book, I got it through him. And I enjoy reading it, and when I read a lot about what Brother Russell says about this chapter, I see that's in Uriah Smith's book. He follows the same line of thought. Brother Russell really picked it up from the Adventist movement. And what they decided to do was, they said, well, okay, in Daniel chapter 11, we'll go all the way down to Magnus. That kind of seems about right. But then we're going to start jumping from there to the Roman, and we're going to go to Julius Caesar, we're going to go to Augustus, to Aurelian, and then Napoleon, and then on. We're just going to start jumping whole centuries of time as we go. And we say, okay, well, let's see how that works, you know? And you can find out how that works. It's in Volume 3. That's where Brother Russell says, well, we all agree in the early part, but now here we're starting with a divergence. And then he explains, that's Julius Caesar, that's Augustus, this is Aurelian, this is Queen Zenobia, and he just starts jumping big blocks of time, and then finally you take it to the end of the 1260, and you're down to Napoleon's day. Now, if you go through that with a fine-tooth comb, and you really look at these scriptures carefully, questions are going to arise. If you go through Uriah Smith's book, where he talks about this in exquisite detail, questions are going to arise. Now, I'll give you one of those questions. One of the applications is that verse 20 that we just finished. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. Do you know how that other approach applies that text? To whom it applies it? If you were to read that in, what book is that?
Uriah Smith.
Uriah Smith, okay. Okay, what does Uriah Smith say about verse 20?
He's got Caesar Augustus.
Caesar Augustus. Now.
He's got Caesar Augustus with the taxation.
Okay.
During the time of
now, you
Jesus
tell me Christ. Why it would make sense to make Caesar Augustus the raiser of taxes in this verse.
If he's going to push it ahead, trying to get all the way down to the French Revolution,
mm-hmm.
It makes sense because
he's going to start jumping big blocks of time.
He taxed the whole world.
But what is there? How do you know he taxed the whole world?
From Luke chapter 2, verse
That's
1.
That's it. You find in Luke the reference to Augustus being a taxer of the whole world. So you say, oh, you know, I'll bet that's the one in prophecy here. That seems credible, but now go to the detail. The detail in verse 20 says, he will be destroyed. He's not going to die peacefully in his sleep. How did Augustus die? Peacefully in his sleep. Yeah, maybe he's the only one. All the others are murdered. But he uniquely died in his sleep. You know, I don't think I would have wanted that job. You know, it came with certain perks, but boy, you know, at the end of it, when you're discharged, it came with a sword, usually. Julius Caesar, how did he die? Roman Senate, and, you know, they all stabbed him to death. Hey, too, Brute, you know, that's where it comes from. But Augustus died peacefully in his sleep. So he wasn't destroyed. Now you might say, well, yeah, he was destroyed by death. Okay, but you keep running into these problems that doesn't quite fit what the narrative's saying. Now, you know, we've gone through all these other details where Brother Russell says everybody agrees on these. They all do fit. They fit really well. They fit to a T. You don't have to bend, stretch, anything. Everything works. Suddenly you get into these jumping generations and it's not quite, it doesn't quite fit so precisely. There was a hand here. Dave?
Just to say how difficult it is to go from generation to generation, Jeff handed me a book here and he said, here's all the dates.
Oh.
And you have that date 187 there at the end of, that would be the end of Magnus's reign.
Yes. Is that about what they got?
Yeah, that's exactly what they have. Okay. And the next one, Philopas, if you want to just write that down, it is one... Where am I at? These names.
So you mean the end of Philopater?
Yeah, 187. Okay, the next one is 175.
Well, let's see, 11 that years from that. Well, I'm going to put 176.
No. I want you to put 175.
Oh. As a risk. Remember, yesterday we learned math is not flexible. You mean for the beginning of Antiochus or the end of Philopater?
For the end of Philopater.
Okay, 176.
175.
175,
I mean. Okay. I don't know. That's the other end of the other one. It's 164.
Here.
Right. Okay.
164 at the end.
Okay. Now that the point I'm trying to make here is that would change the 11 and 12 years you have for those two.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
The total length is the same, but I'm just looking out of the book that Jeff gave me here. I don't know if it's credible
How long does it say those two rulers ruled?
It doesn't say how long they ruled. It just gives you the dates.
12 and 11? That's what it'll come out to. Yeah. Whereas my list has 11 and 12. Okay, I don't know which way it is, but the end result, you get to 164.
Yes, you do.
Okay. Well, very good. I don't know what to say. I'll have to check that out. You know, that's interesting. Now, we're not really making a point too much of the exact dates anyway here, but I'm glad, if there's an imprecision, I should address that, so I'll look at that a little later, and go back to some. By the way, if you check in Wikipedia and see how long Philopater ruled, and see how long Epiphania ruled, I'd like to know. You know, maybe Jeff can check that on Wikipedia just in a moment and see. Maybe that would help us here. But, so I think there's another solution to how to arrive at the right spot. And this is what, you know, we went through our class studies, we went twice through this, at least twice. And we went through this with fine-tooth comb. It's a couple of years separated. But I think pretty much we all realize there's got to be another solution. And I'm going to suggest that the solution is that the conventional point of view is to take Antiochus Epiphanes all the way down to verse 31. And I think that that actually is correct. But here's a problem with verse 31. It can't mean only Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 31 has to have a deeper meaning. Now, why do we say that? Well, tell me, let's read verse 31, and you tell me what you think that means. And then we'll ease into this. Who's got verse 31? Sally, you have it? Okay, but I the number of years of reign.
I can talk
about it. No, they want it for other people. So this is Daniel 11:31. This is a pivotal verse, by the way. So this is deserves our attention.
11:31. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate.
Now, who do you think that abomination that maketh desolate is? What do you think that's all about? Sally, what would you say? Catholic Church? Jacob put in at the abomination of the Mass instead of the ransom. That sounds reasonable to me. But then how can it be Antiochus Epiphanes? Now let's look at Daniel 12, verse 11. Sally, do you still have that mic there?
12:11.
Yeah. Because this is going to refer back to 11:31. That's why I say 11:31 is pivotal.
Daniel 12:11. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be a 1,290 days.
Okay. Now, we've gone through those prophetic days. We went through those yesterday. But you know how those run. They all start as 1260, 1290, 1335. This one is the 1290 is talking about. Where do they all start? With a date. 539. That's right. And this verse that Sally just read says, from Daniel 11:31, that's what it means, from the abomination set up, that's Daniel 11:31. From that time forward, there'll be 1,290 days. So that Daniel 11:31 has to be 539 AD. I mean, unless we're all mixed up somewhere, but I don't think we are. I think we're on the right track. We saw that yesterday. Yes, Jeff?
Uriah Smith has, for Philopater, 11 years.
He does.
But Isaac Newton has 12.
Okay, interesting. So different sources are going to give us different numbers here. Okay, so that, David, is the difference between 175 and 176. But either way, 164, we all agree on, 187.
Henry Fiennes Clinton has 12, so most have 12.
12, okay. You know, I'm going to just mark that down here, 12 and therefore 11. And I'll pay more attention to that next time. I'm glad you mentioned this difference. I'd like to get it right. So what do we do with this? Well, let me ask you, is there any other reference by Jesus to this abomination that Daniel, the prophet, spoke about? That's in Matthew 24, isn't it? Is it verse 15 or so? 15? Who said that? Joyce, you have it in front of you then. Would you read that? Or maybe just to cross-reference. Yeah. So now put yourself back in the minds of the people that are listening to the words of Jesus. And you think what they're thinking from what he's saying.
Matthew 24:15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. That completes the sentence.
Okay. So if you're literally, I'm glad you add that, because if you're literally in Judea when you see this, what are you seeing? You're not seeing Rome. You're not seeing the Antichrist. You're not seeing the man. What are you literally seeing if you're in Judea? You're literally going to flee to the mountains. You know, it does say in Psalm 125, too, as the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so is the Lord round about his people. So the mountains are around Jerusalem. You're going to leave Jerusalem and flee. When you see something, what are you going to see?
Well, in this case, it was the Romans coming in. And if the true believers didn't flee, they would be killed.
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, if you look in the parallel passage in Luke 21, verse 20, here's what he says in other words, just so you get the point. Who's got Luke 21, verse 20? Maybe Joyce has got it. In fact, read 20 and 21.
Luke 21, 20 and 21. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city.
So here's when you see the armies of Rome on the doorstep, then flee. Now, how can you possibly flee the city of Jerusalem if the armies of Rome are invading? How can you get out of there if you see them around the city? Sherelle, explain that to me.
Well, you can if they decide to go away for a little bit and then come back.
That's it. You all know the story. Jerusalem was surrounded, and then one morning they woke up and they saw the Roman legions leaving. I even read a history book about this, Time Life, you know, history book, and they said, we still don't know really why they left. But the Jews said, well, if they're leaving, we're going to chase them. You ever seen, you know, a little dog and a big dog, one chasing the other, and the other chases the other one? Whichever one's running, the other one's going to chase him. And so the Jews go out and chase him. That was anywhere from 66. Finally, the Jews were overthrown in 70 and the Jerusalem destroyed. So in that period of time. So in other words, Daniel 11:31 does have a meaning to 539 for us about papal Rome. But it had a meaning to the Jews about pagan Rome. You remember earlier? Rome was the breaker of the people of Israel. That's when they broke the people of Israel and dispersed them and took their city and burned their temple. So in other words, Daniel 11:31 is applied by Jesus, at least indirectly, to this period. But we all know that it really applies spiritually to this period. It's the same verse that has a meaning to natural Israel in one way, but to spiritual Israel in another way. And that's where we really get meaning for us. We've talked about that quite a bit in the last couple of days. But it has more than one meaning. What I'm suggesting is that if you take the natural flow of Daniel, the 11th chapter, Daniel 11:31 immediately refers to Antiochus Epiphanes. It was true, just what it says. What it says there is true of what he did. Let's look at Daniel 11:31 again with that point of view. Arms shall stand in his part. Oh yeah, he came with an army. They shall pollute the sanctuary of strength. Did Antiochus pollute the temple?
Yes.
He did. He did. That is notable for that. And shall take away the daily sacrifice. Did he do that? Yeah. And shall cast down and shall place the abomination that makes desolate. Did he do that?
Yes.
He started offering pigs, stuff like that. Yeah. So it was terrible what he did. And not only that, you know, Antiochus, he wanted to make sure that everybody followed the Grecian customs. If you're a young lady and you had a child and you're circumcised on the eighth day, you were in jeopardy of death for merely doing what you're supposed to be doing under the Jewish law. Thousands perished under this wicked man. He was the most despicable persecutor of the Jewish people up to that time that there ever was. He was only exceeded by the Roman destruction of the city. But he's an adequate picture then of that Roman, pagan Roman system that would come. And he's an adequate picture for us of the abominable nature of the overthrow of the ransom with the mass and the system that grew up representing Christ in theory that wore out the saints of the Most High for 1260 years. That's papacy. So I think Daniel 11:31 is where we have three threads of prophecy going out from. Daniel 11:31, it's Antiochus, but it's also pagan Rome, and it's also papal Rome. And papal Rome is where the prophetic days of Daniel stem from that are give meaning to us. So that's the way I think that we span this large period of time. And we jump to Antiochus, which is the natural flow of the record, just takes you right there. And then Antiochus, this great persecutor, is a picture of the Romans and a picture of the papal Romans. And there we go forward. Now we can take a separate thread from verse 31 all the way to Daniel 12:1 in three different ways. But now I had some hands, I think. There was some comment? Yes, Jeff.
Well, that was what I was going to ask, because in looking at this chapter and looking at the different, I mean, I've looked at four different possible interpretations of it, and at least three of them seemed like you could make them fit fairly well, so that I'm wondering if there's like a type and a type kind of thing that you've got going on. You've got the actual historical flow, and then you've got like another interpretation built on top of that, and maybe another on top of that, you know. So I didn't used to look at scriptures that way. It always seemed kind of hokey to me, but I've been kind of forced into it by other examples of it in scripture, and so I've kind of conceded that maybe it works this way sometimes.
Okay, all right. Now we'll try to make a case for that. But now we didn't really go into all these scriptures, did we, from verse 21 through 31. I just told you that, you know, a lot of commentaries, they follow it through very naturally, and it does fit Antiochus Epiphanes very naturally. We didn't go through all that. But maybe let's just trace through that a little bit and just see how things fit. So let's go verse by verse. When we get to verse 31, then we're going to pick up the thread and show how it does take us to the Lord's return in 1874 by 12:1. That's where we're headed. But let's go through these verses and see what they say. Now in verse 21... Well, let's start with that, verse 21. Who can do some reading for us? Stefan?
Daniel 11:21.
Yes.
The angel went on to explain, the next king of Syria will be an evil man who has no right to be king, but he will come unexpectedly and seize power by trickery. Anyone who opposes him, even God's high priest.
Well, wait. What are you reading? Are you reading a commentary or the scripture?
scripture.
What version? Amplified, amplified?
It was good news.
Good news?
Yeah.
Okay,
I can go to
that's interesting. Let's have another one that's a little more direct.
okay.
I mean, we're all New following American. In our Bibles. We're saying, well, where?
New American Standard?
Okay. Let's try New American Standard.
In his place, a despicable person will rise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue.
Okay, that's Antiochus Epiphanes. He wasn't next in line for succession. That would be one of the sons of Philopater. But the son of Philopater that would be next in line was in Rome as a captive. And so the next son was just a minor, can't rule. So his sweet uncle says, I will rule on your behalf as a regent until you're, old enough, or until I have the chance to take it for myself. And that's what he did. Just in a very short time, he just dropped all pretense and said, oh, I'm the king. That's all there is to it. He just took over. He took over by flatteries. He came in peaceably. He didn't fight and take it over. He just took it over. And that's Antiochus. Now, verse 22, Stefan.
The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the Prince of the Covenant.
Prince of the Covenant. Now, I know that in the other view that Uriah Smith would advance, and that we have access to that in Volume 3, I know that that's applied to Jesus. But remember this gentleman that I spoke about that was a very, very honorable high priest? What was his name? Onias. That Onias, I think, is the Prince of the Covenant. He's the high priest. He's the leader of the covenant people in religious ways. And he was broken. There were trumped up charges against him, and he was put to death. And it was one of the most regrettable episodes in Jewish history, because this honorable, honorable man was just false charges. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if, when we get all the details all mapped out, it turns out he's a little picture of our Lord Jesus. You remember there was somebody back in the Old Testament, the last martyr that was recorded in the book of Chronicles? Remember Jesus says, all the righteous blood from Abel until righteous Zechariah that was slain between the porch and the altar? The Chronicles is the last book in the assemblage of the Old Testament for the Hebrews. So if you went to that book, you'd see the death of the Zechariah. And he had trumped up charges. This very righteous man was stoned ignominiously and improperly. He's a picture of our Lord Jesus, just like Abel was a picture of our Lord Jesus. I wouldn't be surprised if Onias is too. And this passage is kind of prophetic, of that. But I think literally, it's referring to Onias. Maybe in a prophetic, a deeper sense to Jesus. But, let's see, that was verse 22. Let's go to verse 23.
After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people.
And verse 24 as well.
In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time.
Okay. Now, he was pretty successful in getting the whole empire behind him. And he didn't do it by diplomatic intrigue, and he was just able to accomplish it and get it all behind him. But now what he wants to do what his father Magnus never really accomplished. He wants to go down and take Egypt for himself. And there were very few times when the king of the north actually invaded Egypt. Now, it did happen. It happened a couple of times. We had, before this marriage alliance with the Philadelphus and Theus, there were a couple of wars. And then there was Callinicus that went down and had an abortive, effort to take Egypt. Nobody has ever, from the north, ever invaded Egypt successfully. That's the point I want to make. They've tried a few times. Nobody has ever done it successfully. But now, it's for the first time, it's going to happen. That's the very next verse. That's verse 25.
He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him.
Okay, so it turned out Antioch Epiphanes did invade Egypt. He actually invaded Egypt twice. This is the first time. And the year was 169. Now, if somebody's checking me on these dates, you know, you can double check that if you want. But I'll boldly put up that date here and see if it will stand. I think the first foray into Egypt was 169 B.C. Okay, you're nodding your head in approval on that. Okay, very good. So he was successful. Now, the king of the south, the king of Egypt, put up a good fight, but he just didn't overcome. And that was Philometor. He's the last king here. He's the last king here. They're contemporaries. But Philometor just wasn't able to resist. Now, let me ask you this. What was the relationship between Antiochus Epiphanes and this king of Egypt, Philometor? Are they related at all? Remember, they're all Greeks. Are they related at all? What was their relationship?
Berenice
is up here.
Yeah.
She's out of the picture long since.
Okay, well, she was
go down here somewhere.
Great-grandmother or great-great-grandmother of Philometor and of Epiphanes? No, she wasn't. You're right. Never mind.
Okay.
That was Laodicea.
You're going back to the first marriage alliance.
Yeah, that was Laodicea.
Let's go to the second marriage alliance.
I forgot who that was between.
Okay. There was a second marriage alliance down here between Magnus. And he gave his daughter to Epiphanes, Magnus's daughter. What was her name?
Cleopatra.
Not the one we usually think of, but her name was Cleopatra. His daughter Cleopatra married Epiphanes. And Epiphanes had a son, and his name was Philometor. Now, let's map this out here. Yeah, go ahead. There's Magnus. And he had a daughter, Cleopatra. And he had a son. These are both his sons. So Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes.
But wasn't Antiochus sent to Rome as...
Yes, he
prisoner?
Was. We covered that.
Okay.
And he got free of that, and then he became king. So Cleo had a son, and his name was Philometor. He's the last king. So now you tell me how Antiochus and Philometor are related. That's it, uncle and nephew. That's it. So when Antiochus is invading Egypt, he's invading his own nephew. Now, I have a brother, Rob, and he has, you know, two sons, and, you know, Timothy and Samuel. I like them both. But, gosh, this guy's going to war against them. I mean, that's kind of an odd thing. Yeah. So they both put up a big, notable army, but he wins. And for the first time ever, this northern kingdom actually defeats the south and takes control of Egypt. But, you remember, there's this big power over here that's beginning to prosper, Rome. And so, you know, Epiphanes says, you know, I really don't want to disturb them too much. So he took certain oaths of loyalty from his nephew, and he, you know, made certain compacts and certain agreements with them. Both of them were lying to each other at the time. Well, that's even here in the prophecy. We'll go to Daniel, the 11th chapter. Well, let's look at verse 26 first. Let's see why this young king lost. Verse 26. Stefan, go ahead.
Just to back up, 169, that's verse 25?
That's verse 25, that's correct. That's the first and only successful invasion of Egypt so far in history by the Seleucid Empire. First and only successful one. Yes, go ahead.
I mean, maybe I'm going to get ahead of this whole study or whatever. Is there many levels to this verse 25?
I'm not going to talk about different levels on verse 25. I'm not going to talk about different levels till we get to verse 31.
Okay, okay.
However, you ask a question that I can't really answer. Now, Brother David asked me the same question during the break. He says, I wonder if all these histories have different levels of meaning. I mean, the obvious immediate meaning is laid out pretty good historically. It takes you to Antioch Epiphanes. But is there a deeper meaning in all this history? You know, you go through the book of Acts. Last time I was here, we went through Acts. It's all narrative of exactly what happened. But we found in it a deeper meaning for the whole gospel age. So maybe in all these detailed history. Is there some deeper meaning? Maybe. I haven't pierced that. If there is, I don't know. But you know, we even have a prophecy about Jesus. A child shall be born, and the kingdom shall be upon his shoulders, and all that, you know. You know, back in the Old Testament, when Isaiah gave that prophecy, it meant something then. There was a child born. Before he was 2 years old, he was, before he could say, my mother and my father, certain kings were vanquished. So that's a literal history. That's looking at literal history. But it had a deeper meaning. And the deeper meaning here, I don't know if it does or not. Joyce had a comment, though, before you finish. Joyce?
Well, I have a question. My question relates to these other two questions, so I wanted to throw that out there, too, for all of them. And that is, why did God give Daniel such incredible detail of all these individual people if there wasn't some layered
deeper
meaning?
Deeper meaning.
Yeah.
That's
a
very good question. Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, I'm just wondering on this verse. I mean, this is different than what I've thought before. But I've had some of this. I'm just wondering, you know, would this Julius Caesar be involved in this, and then later on Napoleon? I mean, would these be different ways you could look at these verses, picking up from these and going on?
No. And I say no because I've never heard any credible interpretation that brings Julius Caesar into verse 25 or 26.
Except in Uriah Smith.
No, not even in Uriah Smith. Because Uriah Smith has Augustus back in verse 20. Julius Caesar would be before that. So I've never heard any interpreter say, here, I have a credible position that says Julius Caesar is involved in verse 26.
I mean Augustus. I'm not Augustus.
Oh, I see. Is that what he does? Okay, well then you got something there. Now,
but I'm just wondering because what Augustus did, you know, was 1845 years different.
No. We'll get to that. Okay. That's Julius Caesar, and that's later in the passage.
Okay.
That's later. You're on a good track. It's just the wrong text for it.
Okay.
But okay. Now, when you go through all this, I mean, you go through an exquisite detail. I've done it before. I don't have all the facts at my fingertips. You know, I can't remember all the details. But when I went through Uriah Smith, and that's reflected in Volume 3. But, you know, Volume 3 has a little mistake. He says, we all agree to this point, this is Cleopatra. But you remember I've already talked about it, Cleopatra? It's not the same Cleopatra. It's just a mix-up there. It's just a mistake. But Uriah Smith deals with something, and he goes on. But this is that point of view that says that somehow you can go, you know, skip all these generations. But if I'm not mistaken, verse 20 is where Uriah Smith puts Caesar Augustus. Is that true?
Yes, yeah.
And he's going to be destroyed. Well, that doesn't speak of peaceful sleep, but Augustus died in his sleep. And if that's the death of Augustus in verse 20, what are we doing talking about Augustus 5 verses later? You see, you have to put everything out of sequence, and you really have to kind of get disjointed. And that's, I'll tell you, when you follow those views through, you have a lot of disjointed things. You talk about women leaders like Zenobia with a male masculine pronoun. You know, you got to stretch things. And the farther we went through this, I went through with Sister Chai, you know, to find detailed examination, just point after point. He just doesn't seem to fit. That's why I suggest the real answer is go all the way to verse 31. That's Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the picture of Rome. He's the picture of papacy. And then from there, now we pick up and we have three threads that take you where you want to go. I think that's the real solution. Now, if somebody wants to have the other approach, that's fine. I would just say, let's dialogue after hours, and you explain to me how well it's all going to fit, because I got a lot of questions on it. I just don't think it does. But I think there is a solution. All the expositors face the same problem. How do you get from Alexander to Christ at his return? You got to jump somewhere. And I think the jump is Antiochus from there is Rome and his papacy. Now, this is why it took a lot of pain to go to Matthew 24 and show how 1131 is applied by Jesus to the Roman armies, even before papacy developed. But we take it and say it's also papal Rome, and I think we're justified in that. I think the prophecies require that. Daniel 12 goes back to there to show the 1260 years, 1290, 1335 begin with that. I'm talking real quick here, you know, I hope I'm not losing, you know. But But I really think that this is a very solid point of a way to interpret Daniel 11th chapter. Was there a can back here? Paul.
So, you know, Jesus makes double, or
Jesus gives the future of something that, you know, historically was fulfilled. Why wouldn't we automatically try to do that in the previous verses or have double application?
My answer to that is, show me. But I think it's credible that Daniel 11:31 is the focal point text at which this great, intense persecutor of the Jewish people becomes the model of the Roman persecution later and the model of the papal persecution even later. So to me, it's a fitting jumping off point for three threads of view thereafter. But I don't see it, Paul, going before that. Now, if somebody can show me, I would say, I got my ears open. But I've never seen it even attempted before verse 31.
Can I be clear on verse 31?
Sure.
What the translation is? My translation says, and strong ones out of him stand up.
Okay, that's no problem.
Who are the strong ones?
Well, I think his army. You know, those are supporting him militarily, so stand up and give him the strength. Yeah, we're not quite there yet. But we have jumped there. We have talked about it. So, Sister Mark.
Well, I have a lot of comments in my Bible. I listened to a talk in Chicago once. It was called The Willful King.
Okay.
And I've got comments like in verse 16 about Julius Caesar and Napoleon and all of that.
Where do you have Napoleon?
I had Napoleon down at verse number 19 or 20, somewhere in there.
Yeah,
or was
okay.
It 29 or something?
All right. Now, we're going. That's the other approach, you see. That's the other approach. It follows the Uriah Smith approach, to start jumping generations, you know, and do this. And I think that when you look carefully, that doesn't work. I'll show you why that doesn't work for Napoleon in particular. I'll show you that when we get there. Okay? Keep that in the back of your mind. If I don't address it, call me on it. Okay? I'll show you the problems that come up there. We will find Napoleon. He's going to be in the passage. Just not quite that soon. Not quite that soon. Now, I think the Adventist expositors were so enamored by what they saw with Napoleon ending the 1260 days, they saw him everywhere. But it's just too many places. And I'll show you an intrinsic reason why I think we can disprove that. But it is another solution that is out there, and that's why you would have heard it. Jeff, did you have something?
No.
Okay. Let's continue going through Daniel 11 until we get to verse 31. And then you'll all feel better after verse 31. Okay? I'm pretty sure I can almost promise that. You'll all feel good after verse 31. In this interim, you know, it's a challenge, I know. And you know, if somebody says, you know, I got another point of view I'm going to develop, I'll be listening. I'll be hearing it. Verse 25 is the invasion in 169. Verse 26 explains why the king of Egypt lost this battle. Let's have another reader pick up the thread of thought here. Who would like to volunteer? Okay, Ed. 26, please.
Yea, they that feed of the... Is this on?
Yeah.
Oh. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army... shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain.
Okay. Now, who would be feeding of the same table as the king, Philometer? Who would be feeding at his same table?
Ministers.
His ministers?
His officers.
His officers, his generals, his people. And his generals kind of betrayed him here. And they didn't really strengthen his arm and really do what they should have for him. He's kind of a young king. And, they, you know, he's the nephew, member of Antioch Epiphanes, who himself isn't all that old. And so he's not really supported well by his own officers. And you can go into a lot of history on this. You know, if you want to find this point of view, what I'm saying, look at any really thoughtful commentary, not Uriah Smith, but Barnes or any of Isaac Newton, any of these people, they'll give you this stuff right down the line. This isn't stuff that I dreamed of myself, you know. So in verse 27, let's read that. Oh, go ahead, Brother Ed.
And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed.
Now, who are the two kings in this passage? I mean, in the approach that I'm suggesting. Sister Jackie?
Four.
That's it, and his uncle. Nephew and uncle. There is a family relationship, so he doesn't just behead him, you know, or something like that and take over. He sits down, and they make plans together. And his uncle says, we'll be nice to each other and all this. They're both lying through their teeth. They both have their own agendas. That's what it's saying. These two kings will be have hearts to do mischief. They'll speak lies at one table, but it's not going to prosper because there's going to be problems coming at the time appointed. That's what it's basically saying. And so it's not going to be all smooth and peaceful. There's going to be another hostilities erupting. So now verse 28. This is Antiochus Epiphanes.
Then shall he return unto his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land.
So that's Antiochus Epiphanes. He's going back now from the conquest of Egypt. And you remember, he's a little afraid of Rome. That's why he doesn't really want to just depose his nephew and take over. He wants to kind of be controlling his nephew, but behind the scenes. Doesn't want to agitate Rome too much. Because, you know, if he was to take over this kingdom and this kingdom outright, then Rome would say, you know, that's just a little bit too powerful that for our comfort zone, and we're gonna work against that. So he makes an agreement, you know, lying through his teeth, of course, the both of them, and so he leaves, he goes back to Jerusalem. And here's where the book of Maccabees fills in all the details. It says he went through there, and, you know, he decided, like one of his predecessors, I'm going to take a look in that temple there. And, of course, the priest wouldn't allow it. And so, you know, he was kind of indignant, went back to his land, says, you know, they're not going to get away with this. And so he started really imposing problems upon Judea. And there were serious. Oh, if you read the book of Maccabees on this, it's just incredible. They narrate one example, for instance, this lady who had seven sons. And in turn, each of those sons was roasted to death in a burning cauldron. And all they had to do was recant their faith in Jehovah and agree to follow the Grecian ways and they would live. She watched every one of seven sons being fried in a cauldron. I mean, it's just things that make you shiver. You just can't imagine. That's what this king was like. That's an adequate picture of the great abomination that's going to persecute and wear out the saints of the Most High for so long. And that's the person that would declare death to young ladies who had a son that they circumcised on the eighth day. That's the guy. Yeah.
It's no wonder he went against his nephew. I mean, you wouldn't go against your nieces and nephews, but you can see why he was so ruthless.
That was his character. Yeah. That was just him, yeah. So he's a notorious person, and he deserves the notoriety. And so that's verse 16, that's verse 28. He had indignation against the Holy Covenant. That's talking about the Jews and the Jewish worship. He really did. And he returned to his own land. Now, verse 29, Brother Ed, Stefan, go ahead.
Quick question. What was his first name?
Antiochus.
Antiochus.
All of these are either Antiochus or Seleucus.
The reason why I'm mentioning, there's multiple references in the comments about these verses referring to Aurelian.
I know. That's the other point of view.
Okay.
That's the Uriah Smith point of view, all brought in here. I'll get back to all that, and I'll show you one of the problems that I think can't be circumvented. I've already talked about a couple of them. Like Augustus, you know, dying, you know, destroyed, but he, you know, it doesn't make sense. But I'll talk about it more. Brother Ed, verse 29.
At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter.
Okay. Now, I want to, you're reading King James, right?
Yes.
Oh, man, after my own heart. That's what I use. But it's all right, boy, now and then somebody does this still. But in this case, for the end part of verse 29, I'd like to see here another version. There's something different in another version, I think. Let's 29, yes.
New American Standard?
That'd be fine.
29, at the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before.
That's it. And the King James says, not as the former, or as the latter. Almost sounds like there's going to be a third invasion, you know, coming up. No, it's just that it will not turn out the way it did before. That's it. So he did invade a second time. Now, maybe Jeff can tell me when he invaded a second time. I don't know. I don't have a...
169.
169 is the first time.
No, it says the second expedition.
Yeah, that's right.
They reached Egypt in the second expedition, BC 169.
When was the first expedition?
I probably have to go back to see. I don't have it here.
I don't have it either. I just got the second one.
I don't know. I'm not.
Got to say first name, and what do you expect?
Okay. My sources tell me this was the first time, and so the second time would be a couple of years later or something like that. So I'm sorry, I don't have this in my brain right now. This is what I remember, but I read it recently, Jeff.
So, Cook has 169. Farrar has 168.
For the first or second?
For the second.
Are you sure they say that's the second?
It says, returning from Egypt. Well, where was it? In BC 168, Antiochus again invaded Egypt.
168? Again. Maybe that's the next year. Maybe that's the point.
But Cook has... No, I lost it. Cook had... I have too many books here. Antiochus had hardly reached Egypt in his second expedition, BC 169, before the rumor flashed through Judea that he was dead. So that's when the Jews decided they were going to have a revolt.
Oh, yeah. All that.
And then
Okay. Well, then he invaded in 169. One of those two times. So the other time would be a couple years earlier or a couple years later. Okay, I'm sorry. I wish I was sharper on that and had that right at the tip of my tongue. Paul, did you have something? Okay, so here's the second invasion, and the point is, this isn't going to go the way it did the first time. The first time, he took Egypt, period. Sat down with his nephew and tried to hammer out something. This isn't going to go so smooth. Let's see why not. Why didn't it go so smooth? Verse 30 tells us, Brother Ed.
For the ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant.
Okay. So, the reason it's not going to turn out so well is because even though he came down to Egypt a second time and he was successful, all of a sudden the ships of Chittim came against him. Now, Chittim is maybe referring to this island, and it's the way that the ambassadors from Rome came across and into Egypt, and the ambassadors from Rome said, what are your intentions? And it is a famous episode, you know, the way it's recorded. He says, you know, I'll get back to you. And they drew a line in the sand around him. And they said, the Roman Senate wants a response before you leave that circle. And so Antiochus thought to himself, war with Rome. I don't think I'm up to that. He says, if it pleases the Senate of Rome, we will leave. So this didn't turn out so well. And it didn't turn out so well because verse 30 says, the ships of Chittim shall come against him. That's the Roman ambassadors that came there. Now, in the articles I've got in front of me, those ambassadors are named by name. This is a very, you know, well-recorded episode. And so he left, and he's not too pleased. And so when he goes back up through Palestine, he wreaks havoc there with the Jews. And he continues the persecution. And it just gets very, very bad. Now let's see. In verse 31, arms will stand in his part. They'll pollute the sanctuary of strength, take away the daily sacrifice, place the abomination of desolation that maketh desolate. Such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. And a large part of the leadership of Israel went over to him because he seduced them with flatteries and bribes and stuff, but not any of the good people. Not the Maccabees. Judas Maccabees said, they were at a place called Modin or something like that, and they were going to, some magistrate from Antiochus ordered the swine to be burnt on the altar, and what was it? Some Jew began to comply and began to do that, and Judas Maccabees just couldn't take it anymore, and he killed that Jew that was ready to comply. And then he says, anybody that believes with me in the law of the God of our fathers, you come with me, I'm going to the mountains. And he left, and he got a lot of people to follow him, and that was the revolt of the Maccabees. And you want to see where that is in prophecy? It's in Zechariah. I'll show you where that is. You remember Zechariah, the 9th chapter? That's all about, I mean, we know it's about Jesus, had some meaning to Jesus, but remember we talked the other day about the fact that this is really depicting the campaign of Alexander the Great through Judea. And Zechariah, the 9th chapter, verse 9, thy daughter, rejoice the daughter of Zion, thy king cometh unto thee, he is just and having salvation. But, you know, look, that's Jesus. But literally, just like Cyrus is a picture of Jesus, Alexander is a picture of Jesus. Alexander did this. He brought peace to the city. Now notice what happens after that. Verse 13. When I have bent Judah for me and filled the bow with Ephraim and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of the mighty man. When did Israel ever go to war against Greece? In the period of the Maccabees. Because these are Grecian rulers. Antiochus was a Grecian overlord. And they went to war. And God gave them a stunning victory. This little group of the Maccabees. I mean, these were godly motivated men that could not take the sacrilege anymore. Now, I have a little personal opinion that I think Judas Maccabees and this whole thing put together in prophecy here, I think has a meaning for us. You know, I think it has a meaning at the end of the age about somebody who could not take the sacrilege anymore, straightened out the doctrine of the ransom, and said, if you're with me, let's go to the mountain. What did Jesus say? Flee Judea and go to the mountain. That's the harvest movement. I think that's a little precursor of this, you know, a little symbol, but that's deeper than I should go today. But I just want to show that the Maccabees experience is in prophecy. And if you go through Zechariah, the 10th chapter, that's all about the Maccabees and their success. That's what Zechariah 9 and 10 immediately is about, the Maccabees. It was a godly movement that was preparing the way for the coming of Messiah after, you know, another two centuries. But it was a godly movement, and God gave them a wonderful, wonderful victory. Who could ever believe that Judah would be Greece, you know, or the might of the Seleucid Empire? But they did. So much so, they had to make an accord. They were always still kind of beholden to them. But they had independence and even elected their own kings for a while. So that's so Daniel, the 11th chapter, I think now at verse 33. They that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword, by flame, by captivity, by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they'll be hoping with a little help, and many of them of understanding shall fall, to try them, to purge them, to make them white, even to the time of the end. But that's for in the time appointed. Now, but the king shall do according to his will, Antiochus, and exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. And, you know, it continues on with Antiochus, I believe, until finally, verse 40. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots. And he will enter into the glorious land. Many countries shall be overthrown. But he's okay, now we're going on farther. We're going on to the time of Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar did all this. But I'm going to stop there. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to pick it up from the thread that we usually follow with papacy and things forward from there. Now I'll get back to this other thought after a while. But let's go back to what we're more comfortable with. Verse 31, arms shall stand in his part. He shall pollute the sanctuary of strength. Take away the daily sacrifice and place the abomination that maketh desolate. Who is that in the picture that we usually identify with? Papacy. Setting up the mass, and from there the prophetic days count. So let's take that thread of thought, and let's go from there through the rest of the verses from that point of view. Now, in that point of view, verse 36... The king shall do according to his will and exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. Yesterday we looked at that verse. We saw that Paul quoted that verse, referred to it. What did we conclude yesterday from Thessalonians?
Future.
Future from Paul's day.
Right.
Future from Paul's day. So if future from Paul's day, that means, what does this refer to, future from Paul's day? The king doing according to his will, magnifying himself, exalting himself, speaking against the God of gods? That's the Pope. That's what Paul says. That is this great apostasy. Now let's look back. Let's look compare ourselves with 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. Again, and we're going to get to Napoleon. We're going to get there. But I want to show that this, I don't think, can be Napoleon, because Paul has got a different tact on it. This was 2 Thessalonians 2:4. So let's read that again. 2 Thessalonians 2:4 with Daniel 11:36. See if that's where Paul is referring to. Who's going to read for us 2 Thessalonians 2:4?
I will.
Okay.
This is from the NIV. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God.
Now, who do we all think Paul's talking about there?
The Pope.
Pope, man of sin. I told you yesterday he's not man of sin, a man of lawlessness. But the point is, it's the papacy. Mm-hmm. And the Pope is the head of the papacy. That's it. Where is he getting that from? If not Daniel 11:36. You'll even see cross-references there. You see commentaries connecting those two. That's where he's talking about. Daniel 11:36 is papacy. Now, when I made the point yesterday that it's technically not the man of sin, the manuscripts, the better manuscripts say instead the man of lawlessness. Why did Paul say the man of lawlessness? He's getting it from Daniel 11:36. The king will do whatever he wants to do according to his will. No law is going to control him. He's the man of sin, a man of lawlessness. I keep using that, you know, that's in my brain. But it's the man of lawlessness. All your better your newer translations will say man of lawlessness. He's getting that from Daniel 11:36. Daniel 11:36 is papacy. It's not Napoleon. It's too early to put Napoleon in. You know why he's put in there by Uriah Smith and other people? He's put in there because they're trying to leapfrog this and they get to Napoleon too soon. Napoleon's coming, but not yet. This is papacy. When we saw that, in our studies, it's not hard to see. You just connect it with what Paul's saying. It changes the complexion of the passage. This is still papacy in Daniel 11:36. It's the papacy until you get to verse 40, and that's when papacy begins to end. Go ahead, Dave.
What is Uriah Smith's perspective?
He's a Seventh-day Adventist.
Okay.
And the Adventists, you know, came from William Miller, basically. And they all know, just like we know, that it started with Alexander, the four kings of Greece, of the Persian Empire, and then somehow you got to get to the Second Advent. So we're all faced with the same problem. How do you get from there to there in a rational way? And they're doing it by jumping and jumping, but it doesn't all mesh. And I'm suggesting go to 31 in a very natural way, and then that becomes the springboard for the other, for papacy and for Rome. Okay, now we'll flesh this out in more that I think is going to be appealing to you. I think it is. Just hold with me for a while.
It's already appealing.
Okay. Well, I'm glad for that. It's what Paul's saying. That's a real anchor point. Paul is looking at that and he's saying that is the apostasy. Now, by the way, there's another reason why I think Paul uses the word anomia or lawlessness other than the king doing according to his will. And that's Daniel 7:26. We looked at that yesterday. He shall think to change times and laws until time and times and a half. So that's what papacy does. He knows both those texts are talking about the same thing. And he knows that comes out of the Roman Empire, so that's coming. That Paul knows all that stuff. So I think he's telling us this is the apostasy. So Daniel 11:36 is the apostasy still. Now I affirm we're going to get to Napoleon. Now let's keep looking at Daniel 11:37 through verse 39. And would you take that? Keep reading for us.
Oh.
Yeah. Daniel 11:37 through 39.
He will. Then this is out of the NIV again. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his fathers he will honor with gold and silver and precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god, and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price.
That's the end. That's the end of the description of this ruler that does according to his will. Now, you can look at any number of commentaries by good Protestant theologians that believe that papacy was this man of lawlessness, and see how they apply these texts to papacy's abuses, how they didn't honor any of the things before them. They made their own laws. They exalted themselves. They distributed for bribery and gain. That's how they gained control. And any number of expositors will explain it in this way. What I want to do now is go to verse 40. That's where we're going to start getting Napoleon. Jackie, go ahead.
I think the brothers have sort of asked you this question before about layers to this prophecy.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I've been sitting here silent because Jehovah's Witnesses, they apply that verse to Russia, to the, you know, they it became lawless. It didn't have a God, the God of their forefathers. You know, it was a very religious place before. They're on a different layer of that.
Yeah, they definitely are.
Yeah. So, I mean, but at some point, everything I knew became different.
Yeah.
But they can sort of give you proof text for why they're there.
Okay.
But I think that's one of those layers where they will apply also papacy, but then I think they layer it and they also bring this into the future.
Okay.
And apply this scripture.
Very good. You know, I know the witness, the whole prophetic thinking of the witnesses has kind of become less Christendom involved and more worldwide involved. And that's why they bring in things like Russia and, you know, even in Babylon they bring in Hinduism and all these other Shintoism and all that stuff. That's interesting. And I think I'm just going to take note of that and then keep on the same track we were on. But you're suggesting there's always the option for different layers. And I think they're definitely on a different frame of reference here. Okay, let's go then to verse 40, and I want to see how papacy is going to lose their control. Now, I'm going to do a little racing on the board here, and let's read verse 40. That's enough to begin with, just verse 40. And, okay, this is Stefan.
At the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through.
Okay, now, we have to relocate ourselves. If we're taking the tact that this is no longer Antiochus Epiphanes, we're no longer in the Middle East here. We've got to relocate ourselves. If this is papacy, where does papacy rule from? Rome. So we've got to relocate ourselves here. We're talking about the time of the end. He is going to be impacted by two severe blows, one from the south to begin with, and then one from the north is going to overwhelm him. Now, from the north, who's going to overwhelm him and run through all of his countries and break up the whole system? Who's going to do that?
The
Germanic tribe, of which Franks were one, and that's Napoleon. Napoleon's going to do that. But before Napoleon does it, what's this king of the south that pushes at him? You notice it doesn't say the king of the south overwhelms him. The king of the north will do that. The king of the south pushes at him. What big, large kingdom from the south pushed at Catholic Europe before Napoleon? That's it, the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire took over the Middle East in a 7-year span from 1511 to 1518. Anything else of interest happened during that 7-year span? You got to know, Jeff.
Luther.
And you wonder, how did Luther get away with it? You know, they had a little distraction on their hand. They had the Ottoman Empire down there. And that, historically, some historians look at that and say, you know, that's part of the problem. If papacy had their attention diverted. Okay, you got this rebel monk up here in Germany, but you got the Ottoman Empire banging on our doors in the south. And they kept going. Generation after generation, they kept banging at Europe. They took Buda, they took Pest. That's before Budapest had combined them, you know. And then they kept going, and finally they got up to Vienna. And, you know, you're up to Vienna, Europe's going to fall. Suddenly they're saved. Who saved Europe from the Ottoman Empire?
Poland.
Polish.
Sobieski.
So Bieski the Third, something like that. Now my wife loves this story, you know. But, by the way, I found out she's not really half Polish. She's three quarters Russian. She didn't know that until just recently. Her mother was not full Polish. She was half Russian. So Ruth is only a quarter Polish, three quarter Russian. But she still likes the story about Sobieski. Sobieski saved Europe, basically, from the Ottoman plague, the Ottoman scourge. And he pushed them back. And that was in the 1600s when that occurred. But so that's the pushing from the south. Well, that really, there was a threat to Catholic Europe, no question. But then, it says, from the north comes the second blow, and that's not a push. It's going to overwhelm and pass over and pass through. That's Napoleon. Now, the French Revolution, 1789, Napoleon kind of became a general in 1796 and very much involved. 1799, he took control of things. And then after that, the Napoleonic Wars took the whole thing all the way across Europe. How far did they go through Europe? How far did they reach in the Napoleonic Wars? How far? Russia. To Russia, to Moscow. That's where he overreached himself. The Moscow winter, that was able to take care of him. Yes?
Just to throw a little Romanian itch to it. It was a century before Luther. That Vlad the Impaler was able to repel the forces of the Ottomans as well and save Romania.
Was that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Good.
He saved Romania from the Ottomans, from the Turks.
I feel like I'm getting a little feedback. Is that true?
Also known as Dracula.
Yeah.
Also known as
Dracula.
Really?
Vlad the Impaler.
Okay. All right.
He was considered a hero of the Romanian people, their king.
Okay. Okay. Very interesting. I didn't. You know, I enjoy getting this this other European perspective. Yeah, this is very interesting. Okay, so Napoleonic Wars did come. They really disrupted the whole Catholic system, the whole Catholic control of everything. And after Napoleon's day, they really Catholic Empire was never the same. Never the same after that. So that's, I think, verse 40. Now we're going to talk about Napoleon, verse 41. And Napoleon is described as going into the glorious land. Well, that's remarkable. Napoleon actually went to Israel? Well, somebody...
Just going to try a little fix here.
Okay. A new map. Okay, let's see. Oh, the Napoleonic Wars. Thank you, little Stefan. Thank you. You know, I think you need to come with me everywhere I serve. I'll never have to prepare my own PowerPoints again. So this is Napoleonic Wars that just went over this whole area, and that's all the papal lands, and he really just broke the whole thing apart. Now, Napoleon was no gentleman, you know, but he was God's person for the time. You needed somebody to break the stranglehold, and that's what he did. And when he's finished with his little enterprise, then he went out and kind of faded away in the middle of the Pacific somewhere on the island of whatever it was. And that was the end of Napoleon. But let's look at his demise and his experiences. Verse 41, let's see where he went and what he did. I need a picture of the Middle East here, so maybe we'll have to go back to the other one. There you go. Okay, that's good. That's good. Now, Napoleon comes from France, and he's going to take a passage down here to Egypt. Now, somebody else has their eye on Egypt in the late 1700s, early 1800s. Somebody else has their influence out there. Who was the great naval empire of the time? England. Now, how did England and France get along? Pretty good?
No.
Okay. Well, not so good. Yeah. Okay. Not so good. So Admiral Nelson, I think, was down here, and he confronted Napoleon down here. But we're going to read about that in verse 41, about Napoleon's trip down south. He thought if he would take Egypt, he'd get a lot of glory and honor. And that was his motivation of doing that. Verse 41, who's going to read for us? Esther, would you?
Verse 41?
Yes.
He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand. Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon.
Okay, now I think I'm going to have to draw something up here just the way I want it. And this is like Turkey. And this comes down through Palestine. And then Egypt. There's the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea, the Jordan River. There's Jerusalem. So this prophecy talks specifically about Moab and Edom, does it? And Ammon? Okay. Where's Ammon?
Jordan.
So it'd be like up here, okay? Is that two M's? I think so. And then Moab, down here somewhere? And then Edom, down here somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay. So the point is that Napoleon does not go inland. He's going to take Egypt. Now, it does say he takes Egypt, right? Maybe that's the next verse. Would you read the next verse, Lydia?
Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape.
Okay, so he's going to take Egypt. Now, what year did he take Egypt?
1882. We skipped. I'm sorry. You're talking about Napoleon?
Napoleon. What time did he take Egypt? There you go. 1788. Now, that's highlighted in Volume 3, if I'm not mistaken. 1788.
Got the wrong date.
Say again?
Uriah Smith has the wrong date.
Is that right? What does he say?
He's got 1801 in here.
He's usually sharper than that. Maybe he means something else. But when he actually took Egypt anyway, it was 1798. This is his campaign to Egypt. And then it says, that's verse 42. Now let's go to verse 43, Esther.
But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels.
Okay, the Libyans and the Ethiopians. Now, we've got here on this map, the Libyans would be down here somewhere, and the Ethiopians would be down here somewhere, and they followed his steps. And I think that means they just assented to his power. Now, Sister Marge, this is something you asked me about a long time ago. And you know, I finally found an answer. I don't have the details here, but you know where I got the answer? It was Brother Kumar from India. He did a little research on this and wrote a little paper on it and sent it. And he talked about some historical reference where he did find that Libya and Ethiopia, one or the other or both, actually sent ambassadors or an agreement with Napoleon and fell into line with him. Now, I'm just telling you this loosely. I should provide you the specifics on that. That's an excellent question. But I think what this really means is that because he took Egypt, the other people didn't have a stomach to confront him, and they just kind of fell into line. I think that's what it means is, what does it say? They shall be at his steps. You know, they're not going to oppose him. I think that's the point. Brother Jeff?
In the Wikipedia, it has the French campaign in Egypt and Syria, 1798
yeah.
and 1801. Oh. So I think Uriah Smith is assigning this part of the battle to probably the 1801. The
latter. Okay. Now, let's look at verse 44 and 45, finish out the chapter, Esther.
But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him.
Okay, now he's going to plant his tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Oh, what land is this referring to? Glorious land? Israel. That's right. That's Israel. So he's going to come up here, but he avoids Ammon, Moab, and Edom. So apparently he's going to stick to the coastal route. He's going to go up here. And there was a famous city up here called Acre or Echo. And that's where he's going to be stopped. And after that, he has to hightail it back to Egypt, and then he goes...
Acre right there.
Acre, right up here. Thank you. There it is. Acre, right up there. 1799. That's right. That's 1799. And that's in Volume 3 as well. I don't know if he talks about Acre there or not, but if he makes the point that 1799. So that's Napoleon. And remember, the whole point here is that Napoleon is the one that really laid low the papacy and ended the 1260 days, ended the persecuting power. Now, we're all on the same page on that. So we're all ending up at the same spot, basically, with Napoleon. Now, there's an alternate concept that maybe takes us through England or something. I have some very bright brethren that have this point of view, and I find it very interesting. I'm not going to talk about that today. We've got enough detail on the table. If anybody wants to, it's fine. But I'm not going to go into that in much detail right now. But Brother Paul?
The expression at the time of the end, is that the end of the 1260 days in your mind, or is that what we normally say is the time that begins at 1799 and extends till the kingdom?
I don't think either one. I think verse 40, when it says the time of the end, means the time when it starts to taper down papacy's influence. And I think that begins in the 1500s. I think that's the Ottoman Empire that pushes from the south, and then later Napoleon's going to overwhelm him from the north. And it is true that the 1260 days ended in 1799. And it is true that Napoleon did this conquest up through Palestine in 1789. So I guess you could say that chapter 11 ends, well, you know, takes you up to 1789. But it even goes beyond that, because it says, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Well, in 1789, he was a far way away from being to his end. He hadn't even yet conquered Europe, which he's going to do in the Napoleonic Wars. So after 1799, that's when Napoleonic Wars are unleashed across Europe in wave after wave. And that's when, it doesn't matter how many times he's defeated, he always seemed to go back home and raise another army and go out again. And, you know, even when he was vanquished to the island of Elba, you know, he just had to rule somebody, so they let him rule Elba. And I guess he did okay there, you know, but he managed to get a ship to get back to France, you know, and goes out there, and he's an enemy of France now, kind of, you know, but he goes up to the people, he says, yeah, you want to arrest me, really? I suggest you come to my side, we get an army, and go on. And he says, okay, we're with you. I mean, this man was charismatic, if nothing else. You know, he wasn't a big man, but boy, did he have fire, you know. And I think he was a man of destiny, there's no question. But then so the British had to come over, and finally, at the Battle of Waterloo. And they said, we're not going to put them on an island in the Mediterranean anymore. We're going to put them in the middle of the Atlantic. Get out of there if you can. And that's where he died. And some people think, and it seems highly credible, from the analysis of his hair and stuff, that he may have been poisoned gradually. That's what he thought was happening. He thought he was, but he couldn't get anybody to listen to him. Probably because the poisoner wouldn't listen to him. But anyway, he died in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere. What was the island?
Elba
was in the Mediterranean. Said Helena? Okay. So he finally came to his own, and none came to help him. He is deserted and alone, and he died that way. So that fits him, yeah.
Just for what it's worth, and I'm not sold on either view at this point, but the view that these last half dozen verses have to do with Britain. The king of the north becomes Britain, and then it takes you through the Berlin Congress of Nations and up to World War One and the liberation of Jerusalem by the British.
Thank you. That is true. That is true. That is very good. And there's a very thoughtful paper written from that point of view. A very bright brother. I'll just leave it at that. Just very bright brother. So that's the end of the story prophetically through Daniel chapter 11. Now in Daniel chapter 12, then shall Michael stand up, the great prince that stands for the children of thy people. I'll be happy to give you that reference, Jeff. I'd be happy to.
Okay.
But I don't quite agree with it, so I don't want to speak in a bad light. But I actually think it's a brilliant piece, and as a matter of fact, that piece does pretty much agree with everything we said, except to the very end. Except to the very end. I remember reading that piece years ago, and I remember telling the brother, I haven't paid enough attention to what you've written to really give it a good... And finally, years later, I says, now I have, and you're right. Not in the ending. You know, we didn't come to terms on that, but in most of his paper is just exactly right. It is a very, very well-written paper. I'm not going to tell you it's Jim Parkinson. I'm just not going to tell you. Okay, so now we're going to we're at the end here. From 1799, we're jumping to the in the Napoleonic Wars. We're jumping to the very next prophetic event, And that next prophetic event is the coming of Messiah, the second advent. Now, I want to find out if this is any other passage of Scripture that does the same thing. Is there any other passage that says, you know, we jump from the French Revolution era to the second advent? And I'm going to go to Revelation, the 15th chapter. 15th chapter. No, it's the 11th chapter, verse 15, I'm sorry. Verse 13 and 14 and 15. So Revelation 11, 13, we'll start with that. Who can read, take over? Ben, can you read for us? Revelation 11, 13 through 15. I might interrupt you.
Revelation 11, 13.
Yes.
At that very hour, there was a severe earthquake, and a tenth of the city collapsed. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the survivors were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. The second woe has passed. The third woe is coming soon. The seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven, which said, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Messiah, and he will reign forever and ever."
Okay, so in verse 13, that great earthquake is what earthquake in which a tenth part of the city fell? French Revolution. And he says, now, okay, that's over with. Now we're on our way to the next prophetic event of major consequence. Seventh trumpet. That's the return of Christ. That's what we're doing in Daniel 11. We finished with the Napoleonic era, French Revolution / Napoleonic Wars, and now we're going on to the next event. That next event is the Lord's return. That's when Michael stands up. Now, if you say, well, wait a minute, though, in Revelation 11, we entered the French Revolution, but what about the Napoleonic Wars? Well, I'll suggest to you that that's earlier. If you go in chapter 9, you've got the Napoleonic Wars starting with verse 16 onward, and they ravage Europe. What you remind, you just, it's just bringing your attention back to the fact that it opened with the French Revolution. That's all. It's just a reminder. But it's encompassed, this whole period has encompassed the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. That's what Daniel 11 is doing, and I always really feel encouraged when I see something in Revelation paralleling something in the prophecies of the Old Testament. I say, I think we're on the right track here. I think we are. But Daniel 12:1 then, at that time shall Michael stand up, and the great prince which stands for the children of thy people. There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. Is there any war called? What was the First World War called when it came? It wasn't called the first one. The Great War, to distinguish from everything else that went before. And I think that's the great time of trouble. And then World War II came and they said, this is even bigger. Well, we'll call it number two. And the first one, number one. But it's even more dynamic. So I think these are the winds of war, and that surely indicates we're in the time of trouble such as never was. Now, I think the time of trouble started in 1914 and ends with the seventh plague. I think the whole thing is a time of trouble. It's a war, then the earthquake, then the fire. We finished the war segment. We finished the earthquake segment after 1989, fall of the Soviet Union. Now I think we're in the Islamic fire segment. I think that's the point. Now verse 2, many that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Where does that start? Where were the first ones that slept in the dust of the earth? Where did they come from? Well, who are they? The church. So I think that was after the Lord's return. Then we've got the sleeping saints raised, and now we're going to go onward and upward, and finally the whole world of mankind. And it's got to include the world of mankind. It can't include only the church, because it says, some to everlasting life, some to shame and lasting contempt. And their shame and their contempt will last as long as their shameful character and conduct continues. And when they're reformed, that will start to ease away.
Randy? It speaks of a kind of trouble which will come upon all men.
Yeah.
Isn't that true? There's a reference to that. A time of trouble that will come upon all men.
Okay.
So it's limited. It's limited, but this is
okay. Is that on? Okay. Thank you, Brother Randy.
I won't do it a third time.
There you go. Now I'm hearing it. So I think you make a point here. This has to be something that's greater than ever before. It's more encompassing. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. So that's Daniel 11th chapter. But now that we've got that under our belt, now that we see how it all ends about the time we always thought, And now, I think also the other paper I was talking about does pick Daniel 12:1 at the Lord's return. So we kind of end up at the same spot, you know. So now I want to go back. Now they're all kind of comfortable with that. I want to go back and pick up the other thread of history. You know, the one that starts with Antiochus Epiphanes and doesn't jump to papacy. And what you're going to find is something very interesting. If you take Antiochus Epiphanes and then you take Daniel 11:31 and go on from there, well, these people that are going to be under many afflictions but have many exploits and do pretty good, that's the Maccabees that rebelled against Antiochus Epiphanes. And he's going to be this person that does whatever he wants. He's going to rebel against the God of gods and all that. But he's going to be brought low. He's going to come to his end. And then, who is it that's going to take the dominion after the Syrian Empire? Who becomes the next kingdom? Maybe let's go back to a bigger map of Europe. There we go. Who's going to be the next empire after all this stuff is finished and after Antiochus Epiphanes is off the scene? Rome. So Rome is the one that really is going to subsume all of that. Now, they didn't lay down their arms and say, come and, you know, we'll let you rule us. This was a conflict. So they had to overcome them. Now, who was it that overcame Antiochus Epiphanes? It was from the north. The north overwhelmed that whole kingdom. And that's verse 40 again. He's overwhelmed by the king of the north, which in this context is, I think, Rome. A little bit north, a lot west.
Is it general?
Okay. Well, finally, when this whole thing is subsumed, tell me, who was the king of Rome? The Caesar of Rome, that conquered this. Who is Julius Caesar? Julius Caesar. Do you know what date Julius Caesar took Egypt?
Bill knows.
I don't know, didn't you? You and I have talked about it.
I thought we had it the other night.
I don't know. Maybe we did.
You would stop for a break?
Well, okay. If you want to stop, it's okay. But I was waiting for you to comment on this question.
No, I don't.
Okay. Okay, when did Julius Caesar take Egypt? He first took Egypt, not when Cleopatra was defeated.
48.
Yeah, there you go. 48? 48?
August.
Let's see. What am I doing here? Let's see. Yes, okay, thank you. It's 48. 48 is when Julius Caesar took Egypt. And then what did Julius Caesar do after he took Egypt?
He died.
No, not yet.
He went back to Rome, didn't he?
He did ultimately, but he did something else before he did it.
The first Herod there, Herod the Great.
He didn't leave Herod the Great here.
In Egypt. Went on his way back from Egypt.
So he went up to Palestine, you're saying. Okay, so in 47 B.C., this is B.C., he did what Napoleon did. He took Egypt 1 year, and the next year he went up through Palestine. He didn't go to Ammon or Moab or Edom, but he went up here, and then he did what Napoleon did. He left and went back to his homeland and took control. It was after that that Napoleon in 1799 really became the ruler of France. You know, we mentioned the point the other day. In 1798, Pope was taken out of Rome as a prisoner, but he died. But Napoleon wasn't in charge. But he died the next year in 1799 when Napoleon was in charge. Well, that was it. He took Egypt and then 1799 here, and then went back and took control of France. Julius Caesar did the same thing. In 48, he took Egypt. In 47, he went up through here. He went back to Rome and took control. Got nominated as emperor for life or something like that. It's a dangerous post. Because life can be limited. And that's why they had to stab him to death in the Roman Senate. They said, this is supposed to be a republic here, and you made it an emperorship. And for life. Well, okay, your term has expired. And that's why he died. That's why he did. But so he came to his own and none helped him. But the interesting thing about this is, if you want to take it from Antiochus through Julius Caesar, and then Michael stands up, who is Michael? So what would that be, Michael standing up sometime after Julius Caesar? First Advent. When did Michael become Messiah, the anointed? When was he anointed? At the age of 30. What year was it? 29. So let's put that here. Let's say that was... okay. Now, ultimately, this comes to... finally, Jesus stands up in 1874 in this approach. And finally, Jesus comes in 29 A.D., in this approach. Now, here's the interesting thing. How many years is it between 1874 and 29?
1845.
That's right. How many years between 1798 and 48?
1845.
1799 and 47? Everything is happening to Julius Caesar just the way it would happen later to Napoleon, exactly 1845 years apart. Now, that number is meaningful to us. It wouldn't be meaningful to Uriah Smith, but we all know 1845 is the time between the two Advents. I think this is remarkable. I think this shows we're on the right track. There are two levels of meaning. It is Antiochus, goes through Julius Caesar, comes to the first Advent. Any Jew could appreciate that. What do all the Jews think verse 31 is? Antiochus. That's what they think. And so that would take them right to the first Advent. If they're thoughtful about it, that would show them Jesus is their Messiah. But now for us, we say, well, we're going to take that as papacy, because the prophetic prophecies seems to demand it, and Revelation seems to demand it, so we take that as papacy, we go through Napoleon, we get to the second advent of Christ. Oh, it all works. It all works. We're on the right road. You know, when you see things that are organized, symmetrical, pattern, you say, this is intelligent design, this is intent. Now, we got a third level we're going to go through, but we're going to take a break. We're going to take a break first. We'll turn over to Brother Bill, and then we'll talk about that third level.